following program is provided without charge by Reformed Theological Seminary, which reserves all rights. To learn how you can support RTS, please visit give.rts.edu.
All right, how had Christianity taken root in ancient Africa as the faith spread along the African northern coast and in the Mediterranean world? We have already talked about a number of very important African fathers. I have not talked about Cyril as much. He's another one of the prominent African bishops who's left us a number of writings, but we certainly have talked about these other five in a significant way. And don't forget, when we were drawing this distinction between some of them being a part of the Greek church and part of the Latin, that North Africa really was divided in terms of its allegiance both by language and culture and to the bishops. For example, the more western part of North African, Hippo, Carthage, in that area, its allegiance was more to the Bishop of Rome and considered a part of the Western Church in that language. Their theological writings were in Latin, whereas these other fathers were Greek. So even though they're all North Africans, there was a language and culture distinction there, but they are typically put together as a part of the heritage of the church. The other factor, which we're going to get to shortly, after we finish the unit on St. Augustine and African Christianity, we'll talk about the emergence of monasticism, which also took place in Africa, in the Nile River Basin. Up and down the Nile is where these earliest monastic communities were born. And of course, that is a huge factor in shaping Christianity. Because as we move into the Middle Ages, all leaders in the church, without exceptions, were monks. All of them. The bishops, the priests, came from those ranks, especially the bishops themselves. And Mark Knoll has argued that the emergence of monasticism in Africa is one of the great turning points in the history of the church for that reason. This is where all the leadership for the church is going to come long term, up until the time of the Reformation. So Africa making a huge difference. And of course, Africa was under siege repeatedly. Not only the Roman persecutions, we've talked about Perpetua and Felicitas and these other bold women that suffered in the persecutions of Africa. The Donatism, which racked the church for a number of centuries, that we'll look at this morning as we talk about St. Augustine's dealing with this great division in the church. The barbarian hordes, the Vandals, will come over from Spain down into North Africa. When St. Augustine is dying in Hippo, the Vandals are destroying the city when he's on his deathbed. It's taking place right at the end. So this is going to wreak havoc in North Africa. And then, of course, the most devastating of all is the Islamic invasion, which for all practical purposes almost completely wipes out Christianity in North Africa. One of the sad parts of the story. But even in the midst of that, with all of these challenges that Africa would face, I would suggest to you that out of Africa comes the greatest theologian that the church has ever had, and that's St. Augustine himself. And everybody wants a piece of St. Augustine. The Catholics love him, and the Protestants equally love him. Now, it is true we tend to emphasize different parts of his writings and contributions to theological discussions. We Protestant types typically love his soteriology. The Catholics love his ecclesiology, his doctrine of the church, and we're going to talk about both. B.B. Warfield made an interesting comment about the influence of St. Augustine on the Reformation. Here's what he said about the Reformation. He said the Reformation was the victory of St. Augustine's doctrine of grace over St. Augustine's doctrine of the church. He said that's what the Reformation was all about. It was the victory of St. Augustine's doctrine of grace over St. Augustine's doctrine of the church. And that's a obviously oversimplified, but it makes a legitimate point that there was a certain part of St. Augustine that the Reformers felt like had been too neglected, which they believe was the most important part of his legacy for the church. And that's what they latched on to as they tried to reconnect the church to its ancient heritage. Well, one of the most famous conversion stories throughout our history is the conversion of St. Augustine. And one of the reasons for that is it has been left to us in his great book, The Confessions, which he writes about 10 years after his conversion. As St. Augustine experiences this work of grace in his life, this book has been such a blessing to so many people over the generation, and it's been in print ever since he wrote it. People made hand copies as they could get a copy of it. When the printing press emerges, people wanted to be able to read this wonderful treatise, which describes this story of this very intelligent man walking through the journey intellectually of coming to Christianity, and how God's grace just totally changed everything. And a very gifted Latin writer, and the beauty of the language expressed there is kind of overwhelming sometimes.
What's the name of that book?
The Confessions. The Confessions of Augustine. It's just called The Confessions. Mm-hmm. And I want to, we'll look at it a little bit closer here shortly. But I want to just say a few things about his conversion. Some of you may very well have already read The Confessions, and most people at least heard of some of the details of his life. Know about his great Christian mother, Monica, who's known as Saint Monica. She is a great example of a Christian mother who's relentless in praying for her children. And Augustine describes this, of how his mother would not give up. And at one point when he becomes a Manichaean, which was kind of a later version of Gnosticism in Augustine's intellectual journey, the Manichees gave an answer of an eternal light in darkness, which good and evil being both eternal satisfied him intellectually for a while, and he was kind of drawn to Manichaeism. But when he embraced that, Monica kicked him out of the house for a while. She wasn't going to have a Manichee. It was one thing just to be a pagan and not fully come to Christ, but she wasn't going to have that. But he got an excellent education. And he details this in the Confessions, studying rhetoric. We've talked about the importance of that. Augustine will also be known as a great preacher also. He describes going off to school, born in the city of Thigaist, which would be today modern-day Algeria, there in North Africa. And in the Confessions, he talks about one time when he's home from school, the infamous pear tree incident, which he saw as a paradigm of human experience, as he reflected on it later as a converted man in his 30s. He was about 16 years old. He's out with his buddies one night at dusk, and there's some property adjacent to his father's property, and had a tree full of luscious pears. And the boys apparently had plenty to eat. It wasn't because they were necessarily hungry, but they went over and stripped that tree of all of its pears and threw the pears to the pigs. And Augustine, as an adult, kind of thinks about this childhood experience. He says, now, why did I do that? He said, I wasn't hungry at the time. It wasn't because I necessarily wanted to impress my friends with just doing this. He said, we just did it because it was something bad to do. We loved the evil of doing something we were not supposed to do, and we delighted in it, just because it was pure evil. And he said that's a picture of what the human heart is like. We sin because we love to sin. We just do it because we enjoy it. And it's evil and we delight in it. And after his conversion, you know, the darkness, you know, of his own heart and his own grappling with sin became so real to him. And it's why I think his expression of his Christian experience so many people have resonated with over the centuries. He's gut level real. He marries, takes a concubine at the age of 17. At the age of 19, he becomes a father, his son Adeodatus. He talks very graphically and openly in the Confessions about his struggle with the sexual lust. And he lived with his concubine for over a decade. And at one point, finally, his mother talks him into getting rid of the concubine and says, I need to get you married to a decent woman so this can be official. He finally agrees to do it. We never know who the name of this woman that he apparently loved very much, lived with for 10 years. He never, ever mentions her name. She's sent away. But before his mother can arrange this new marriage, he takes another concubine. Again, evidence of just the sexual struggles that he faced. And he talks about this issue of what he would in Latin would call concupiscence, this ardent desire of the passion. And he talks about in the Confessions as he's trying to, as he's beginning to reconsider Christianity. He was aware of Christianity. His mother was a believer. His father had died when he was younger. And as he considered these things, especially as he moved to Italy in Milan, he had been given a professorship there, and he sits under Ambrose's teaching, and he's very impressed with this. And again, he is starting to consider Christianity because Ambrose was a Platonist. This is where scholars point to the Platonic influence in Augustine's thinking. Because Ambrose was very knowledgeable about the Platonic heritage and was able to communicate Christianity in some intellectual ways that Augustine could get his hands around, for the first time, the answers of Christianity were beginning to satisfy him intellectually. But he still had this inner struggle. And at one point in the Confessions, he actually says, God, deliver me from lust, but not yet. I mean, how more honest can you get than that? You know I need to get rid of it. Don't do it yet. I still love, my sin. And in the Confessions, he describes this journey. The famous event that shows up in the confession is during this time of struggle, he's been listening to Ambrose preach. He's thinking through the faith, and he just details this journey. It's a great illustration of the fact that, you know, there are people that have dramatic conversions and there are folks that have a long journey to the cross of Christ. And Augustine had a long journey. And it was an intellectual journey, a spiritual struggle. And he talks about one day in, this is at the end of Book 8, where you find his conversion experience. He talks about that day that he was in a garden, and he was starting to read the Bible, and as he's reading, and he's distressed in his soul about things, and he says, I flung myself down, how long I know not, under a fig tree, giving free course to my tears. And the streams of my eyes gushed out as an acceptable sacrifice unto thee. He is so perplexed and struggling, he's just weeping uncontrollably as he's trying to find peace with God. And he cries out, O Lord, how long must it be? Why is there not an hour to my, why is there not an, in this hour an end to my uncleanness? And then he records, and as I was saying these things and weeping in the most bitter contrition of my heart, lo, I heard the voice of a boy or girl, I know not which, in a neighboring house, chanting and repeating, take up and read, take up and read. In Latin, tole lege, tole lege. And what he did, he said, he immediately returned to the place where I had been sitting, and there I'd put down the volume of the apostles. I rose thence, and I grasped the book, I opened it in silence, and here's the paragraph on which my eyes fell. And we typically suggest as ministers, people don't do that. When you want to seek God's guidance, just open the Bible and see where your eyes fall. But here's what Augustine said, this is what I did. I just opened it and here it was. Romans chapter 13. Not in rioting and in drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying, but put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. No further would I read, nor did I need, for instantly as the sentence ended by a light, as it were, of security infused into my heart, all the gloom of doubt vanished away. And he describes how in that experience, conversion comes to him. And then at the beginning of Book 9 is one of my favorite passages in the whole book, where now that he's experienced Christ and he's freed, the freedom that he had so longed for had come. Here's how he describes this new freedom. He said, what at one time I feared to lose, it was now a joy for me to put away. For For you did cast it away from me, thou true and high sweetness. You did cast it away, and instead of them, you did enter in yourself, sweeter than all pleasure, though not to flesh and blood, brighter than all light, but more veiled than all mysteries. Now was my soul free from gnawing the gnawing cares of seeking and getting and wallowing and exciting the itch of lust. And I babbled unto thee my brightness, my riches, my health, the Lord my God. But isn't that a classic definition of conversion? What I feared to lose was now a joy for me to give up. That's true conversion. And what he couldn't let go of himself, God took away from him. And his conversion experience. Well, after Augustine is converted, he spends some time in seclusion thinking about all these things. What had God done in his life? He and his son Adeodatus are baptized together by Ambrose there in Milan. He talks about he and Monica having a mystical experience of God in a place called Ostia, where they had gone for retreat for a season, and experiencing, he said, the wisdom of God, a special encounter with God. Adeodatus will die as a teenager, and this is very painful to him. His mother Monica will pass away, but Augustine begins to sense this call to serve in the church. And he was very reluctant at first, but it was obvious that this man now in his 30s, very gifted, that needed to be put to use in the church. He eventually will become the bishop of Hippo. The old bishop noticed the giftedness and turned over the preaching duties there. And when he passes away, Augustine now becomes the bishop. Now, we ought to recall that when we think about his ministry as a bishop, that he was involved in a lot of different things. We certainly think of him as a great theologian that spent a lot of his time writing. I mean, the catalog of books that St. Augustine wrote is almost mind-boggling. He and Thomas Aquinas, without having a computer or typewriter or anything, these mammoth manuscripts that they produced. Isidore of Seville, a later medieval Spaniard, once said, he said, anyone who says they have read all of St. Augustine is a liar. You just can't, the corpus is so huge, you just can't read it all. But in addition to all of his wonderful contributions there, he was a preacher, a bishop who, and bishops typically had to judge cases and disputes among people in the church, and even sometimes civic cases, so he had a very busy life, preaching regularly to the people, fighting heresy, not only dealing with the Donatism, the Pelagian issue, there were still some vestiges of Arianism in North Africa that was somewhat of a concern. We also see in Augustine that after his conversion, he really did make a commitment to celibacy and to protect himself from those temptations. He basically set up kind of a little monastic community right there in Hippo. He lived with a small group of men and made a commitment that he would never be in the presence of a woman alone unless there were other men around for the rest of his life. And now, a lot of people like to criticize St. Augustine and say, well, he just had so many sexual hang-ups, he was just kind of bizarre. Because he does seem in his writings to talk about, these struggles very real. Everybody's experience is different, but this was his besetting sin, if you would. And so that is something that naturally comes to his mind when he thinks about the category of sin. But he took his conversion very seriously, and his testimony here is God did take a lot of that just away from him. And he says, the joy that I found in that, he said, I now found joy in the Lord himself. Well, the Donatist and Pelagian controversies would be the two major areas of dissent that would consume so much of his time during his ministry. And notice the number of years there. Really over a decade in both instances where he's having to struggle and wrote multiple works during both of those controversies. And you find references to it in his sermons and, whenever he's writing, you can see that this is kind of in the back of his mind. Now, one of the great things that we have in relationship to St. Augustine, and this is so rare, is at toward the end of his life, he wrote a little piece called the Retractions. In Latin, the Retractiones. And it is not very big, but what he does is he goes back now as a mature man and he gives his late in life comments about his earlier writings. Now, who is perfect in what they either say or write, and who doesn't change their mind on occasion about, you know, I believe one thing and looked at it now. So we have some keen insight on some of the transition in Augustine's thought as a part of the Retractions. He'll go back and he'll comment on some of the things that he says in the City of God or the Confessions or in his writings on the Trinity. And it's just a cool piece that we have. We don't have other major theologians that have done something like that other than comparing a later piece they would write in an earlier piece. But here he kind of goes through the main things he had done, and that really helps us understand the great theologian. He dies in the year 430. His a good friend and pupil of 40 years, Posidius, wrote a life of St. Augustine and describes in those final days that what Augustine did. It shows you the keen sense of sin and the reality of that, that as the Vandals were destroying the city and really burning it down, Augustine asked that the penitential psalms be written on papyrus and attached to the wall, and he died reciting the penitential psalms until he deceased, just wanting to go out of this world, continuing to repent of his sins. And, it's a poignant reminder that Augustine's known as the doctor of grace. Grace doesn't mean that we don't have to continually repent of our sins for all of our life, even though we're, justified before God. And Augustine really lived this out. And I'll tell you, the greatest contribution Posidius has given to us, Augustine's writings, he hid them and protected them from being burned. Can you imagine the loss to the church if the works of St. Augustine would have been burned, his Hippo burned? He hid his library in his final days. And we can give thanks to God for that important little piece of the story of St. Augustine. Well, there's kind of an overview of his life-famous Renaissance painting. Everyone throughout the Middle Ages, had to interact with St. Augustine. Any theologian worth his salt had to integrate Augustinian material into his writings, interact with it, and much beloved, certainly by the Renaissance and Reformation men, and ever since the time of his life. Now, we can't look at everything, obviously, but in addition to looking at the Pelagian and Donatist controversies, I do want to focus a bit on his three major works. I think every good seminary student, I think every Christian ought to know a little bit about these three major works of Augustine, and so since we have to make some choices, I'll see if we can try to focus on these. But why don't we go on and take a break now? It's been about an hour, and we'll come back and begin by looking at these three. All right, let's talk about these three great works of Augustine. And I think it's be insightful for us to be aware of these great works. Now, the Confession is one we've already talked about a little bit. Sometimes the question comes up about the Confessions. What were, the purpose of this great autobiography? But we'll look at that and try to get a handle on what Augustine was after there. De Civitate Dei, that's the Latin name for the City of God. I'll get to the slides. You'll see my abbreviation. DCD, excuse me. For the City of God, just so I don't have to write it out all the time. But De Trinitate. Now, one interesting thing about that title, there are lots of fathers that wrote works entitled De Trinitate. It's whenever they would write a treatise on the Trinity, they would just typically give it that title. But when you read scholarly works, whenever you see it listed, In the Latin, it usually refers to St. Augustine's work, because it's considered one of the, you know, key texts from the ancient church. So when you see De Trinitate somewhere, most often that's referring to St. Augustine's work, whereas other writers, they'll usually just translate it as the Trinity. So it's kind of known by its Latin title more than the others. Famous passage in the Confessions. We can begin by looking at that particular piece where Augustine begins the book, "Great art thou, O Lord, greatly to be praised. Great is thy power, and of thy wisdom there is no end. And man, being a part of thy creation, desires to praise thee. Man who bears about with him his mortality, the witness of his sin, even the witness that thou resist the proud. Yet man, this part of thy creation, desires to praise thee. Thou movest us to delight in praising thee, for thou hast formed us for thyself, and our hearts are restless till they find rest in thee." Probably the most famous little line in all of the Confessions. But you'll notice the theme here of praise, and the fact that God's really created us to be in fellowship with Him. And so much of the Confessions really, you know, reads like this. It is an offering of praise unto God. What is Augustine really after here? It is the first autobiography we have from the ancient world. And what exactly is Augustine confessing? Is, you know, his focus on how sinful he is? Or, you know, is he trying to draw attention to his conversion experience? It appears that the great theme of the Confessions really is his confession of the grace of God. And that's what he tends to point toward. And even in the retractions at the end, he says, "What did I speak of in the Confessions but of God's grace in what he had done?" And that does seem to be the central element. And why he writes the Confessions, he wants to encourage the church in their appreciation of the grace of God and the transforming power of that. Now, the Confessions have 13 chapters, or books, as they are typically described. The first 10 deal with kind of the narrative of his conversion and his Christian experience. Then the last three deal with a number of different issues, talk about time and creation, eternity, that kind of thing. So usually when you talk about the story of his life, you're talking about the first two-thirds of the Confessions. And he kind of gets theological in the last parts of it as he reflects on a number of different things. There are a lot of famous passages in the Confessions from the lips of Monica and, you know, Augustine, and I've made reference to a few of those. I'll admit my favorite one, it's toward the end, it's one of the last three books. He's actually quoting someone else, but he raises this question. He says, the question comes, what was God doing before creation? He said he was creating hell for people that ask too many questions. I think that's a good one. The point being, you know, there are probably some questions we ought not to ask. But if you've never read the Confessions, I encourage you to consider that. It's very devotional. Great read. Now, The City of God, I can't make the same kind of recommendation on that one. It's much, much, much longer. There are portions of it that you can just get stuck in because there are times when he is interacting with pagan thought. And if you are not a philosophy major and are aware of a lot of that, you can kind of get lost in the shuffle trying to read through that. But yet there are other portions that are very alive and have much worthy stuff. So you may, you know, have the chance to read it through at least once just so you can say you did. But my guess is you might have a chance to be selective and read some portions of that. Now, the catalyst for him writing The City of God was the fall of the city of Rome in 410, when it was attacked in August of 410 by the Visigoths under Alaric. There was not only a strong Christian presence, obviously, at Rome at the time, but still a significant pagan contingent. And the pagans immediately began to cry out against the Christians. It happened again. We're having this judgment from the outside because of the desertion of the worship of the gods by these Christians. There were still pagans around. In fact, one evidence of the influence of paganism, there still was a pagan altar in the Roman Senate, even in the Christian Empire. Ambrose preaches against it. He was irate about this pagan symbol, you know, in government. But Augustine, during his period of transition toward his conversion in Christianity, did spend at least a year in Rome. The pagan elects were very impressed with him. He rubbed shoulders with the upper echelons of society there, and so he's very familiar with the pagan party in Rome. And so when these complaints start coming out against the Christians, and he was encouraged by some of his friends, look, you need to write something about this to defend the faith and also to answer some of these accusations against Christians. And it got real personal because not only did Christians flee from the Italian peninsula and come over into North Africa, many of the pagans actually came into North Africa also, crossing the Mediterranean to escape from the barbarian invasion. So they're really in his backyard. It appears that some of the themes that Augustine will write about in the City of God, he'd already done some thinking about, because we find in some of his letters some of the ideas that he will describe here. But he does begin putting pen to paper, if you would, and trying to answer some of these questions. But more and more, he was being urged to write a full response to this kind of thing. We have one of his letters, though, where he talks about the suffering of the Christians, and he says, look, this kind of thing was prophesied by Christ, that Christians are going to suffer. You ought not to be so shocked. The Christians' homes have been destroyed and Christian women have been raped. These are terrible things, but Christ foretold that these kind of things can happen. And he encouraged Christians to refrain from their murmuring about these things.
I mean, if I understand correct, according to this reading, it was like Augustine had charged that Rome failed due to their abandon of the classic paganism for favor of Christianity.
All right, say that again. Make sure.
Here in the book,
okay,
it says Augustine is sensitive to the charge that the fall of Rome was due to its having abandoned classic paganism in favor of Christianity.
Right, and that's what I was saying. That was the charge that the pagans were making. Of the judgment. You're exactly right that's what was going on.
The pagans that was making that.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Okay.
Right. And so he's wanting to answer, and it's a part of the explanation for why so much of the City of God is an answer to old pagan philosophy. Because he goes beyond just initially dealing with that. I mean, it's a full-bore attack against everything that paganism was about. And he goes after a lot of different things, and I'll mention a few of those. So he writes the letters, and then in 412 he begins what he calls his magnum opus et artem, my great and difficult work. And he's going to give a lot of energy to this over time and spend approximately 15 years writing this work. And it consumed a lot of his energy. Here's a drawing of a popular conception of the City of God, the City of the Devil or City of Man. He uses those terms interchangeably in the City of God, these two great entities that are in conflict from the beginning of time, and that God is involved in bringing the City of God to conclusion. What's the plan and purpose of the City of God? And this is a good illustration where the retractions, he definitively outlines it for us. He says, this is what I was trying to do when I wrote the book. He says, in the first five books, I wanted to go after the pagans who were blaming the Christians and lay out my arguments. And then books 6 through 10, this is the very intricate discussion of paganism. And he'll just cite different philosophers and their ideas going way back. And remember, this was his background. He had studied rhetoric and philosophy, been influenced by these things as a younger man, so very well versed in these things. And he goes into significant detail here. By the time you get to book 14, is kind of the guts of it in terms of laying out his perspective on what this city of God is, as he'll describe the origin of the two cities, the city of man and the city of God. Then in the next section of the books, he'll talk about the progress of the two cities through human history. So where they came from, where they're going, and then as you get toward the end, he'll talk about the goal of these two cities and where they're going to end up, their destiny, if you would. Now just a few things I want to mention here about some elements in the city of God that are addressed there, which I think have some implications for us and to give us an idea of the kinds of philosophical questions that St. Augustine is trying to deal with. One of the issues that's always been controversial when you think about St. Augustine is, what is his relationship to Platonism? How influential was it? And this whole main idea of this incomprehensible one and the unity of all things and the fact that we have unity with God through contemplation. This basic Platonic premise, which had been repopularized through Plotinus in the Neoplatonic movement. One of the places where, even in contemporary times, this critique still comes up in Augustine's Doctrine of the Trinity, and I'll say something about that momentarily. But I think the long and short of it, I would argue in looking at it, and this is not unique to my perspective, but I really sense in my reading of the City of God, and yes, I actually did have too much to drink and actually read the whole thing one time. I'm kidding. It was, because it's very laborious. He cites Plotinus favorably at least a dozen times in the City of God, where, you know, what he says is right on target. And Augustine, beginning with the premise that all truth is God's truth, it appears that he was wanting to indicate some places where Plotinus had discerned some principles that are what we might call common grace insights into the world and humanity that he had shared there. But there are other places where he explicitly goes after Plotinus in his error. So you find kind of a balance in Augustine there. But in the retraction, interestingly, he does say at the end of his life, he says, I think I praised the philosopher too much. And here he's referring to the great philosopher Plato. I think I praised him a little bit too much. So having thought about it a little bit more toward the end of his life, he recognizes that there should be a great criticism against that. And I'll give you some illustrations of this and where he really confronts Greek thought in his unique articulation of some of the Christian doctrines, especially when you get to matters like the doctrine of creation, where he's got to address in the philosophical question. We've already talked about how for the Greeks, they considered matter to be eternal. And this is why they had such a problem with the Christian notion of creation. And Augustine is very clear about the fact that God brought the world into existence out of nothing. Matter is not eternal. The only thing that's eternal is God himself. And he even brought matter into existence. And this is certainly intended as contrary to Greek idea. The Greeks had said, well, if you talk about creation not being in matter not being eternal, is this describing a change in God? Because for the Greeks, they always wanted to talk about how God is immutable and unchangeable. It was another reason why they objected to the idea of the incarnation. How can the deity change from their vantage point in taking a human form? For the deity is immutable. But Augustine argues in terms of creation that no, there is no pre-existing matter. Creation, as we like to say in Latin, ex nihilo, out of nothing. This was a big art. He also talks about that as a part of creation, God created time. And Augustine, this was a matter of discussion. He only talks about in the Confessions, but also here in the City of God, that God created time too. If time is the whole issue of memory and expectation in the human mind and how we calculate time, that God brought this into existence also. Just as he created matter, he created time. Now the creation of man specifically, the Greeks had talked about this repetitive cycle of human existence, that particularly in a Platonic framework where we enter into a bodily existence, and then when we die, we enter back into this world of ideas, and then reborn, if you would, back into a body. And Augustine says, well, this is nonsense. How can this be really a state of bliss or happiness? He says, even when the soul is back united with the immutable one in this world of ideas, you'd be miserable there because you're anticipating I'm going to have an embodied existence again. Body and soul are in union, and this is a good thing. The body is good. And taking a Christian point of view here, he argued that this is not a negative thing, but something God had intended for the union of body and soul, and that rather than this repetitive cycle of human life, that history is linear. And we do look forward to the resurrection and the soul being reunited with the body. Now, he makes a unique contribution to the question of evil. And you may have been aware of this unique distinctive of St. Augustine. Now, he had been a Manichaean in his earlier years, which had a philosophy that had talked about evil being eternal and existing from eternity, just like light and good exists from eternity. And this is the cosmic conflict, is the Manichaean answer. But as a believer, he rejected that, and the way he came to understand the existence of evil is, he says, essentially what evil is, it's the privation of the good. It's the absence of the good. Evil has no existence in and of itself. Everything God creates is good because God is good. Evil has no existence in and of itself. All that evil is the absence of the good. Now, you know, people have grappled with that idea. Is that legitimate? Other Christian thinkers have wanted to see, put more emphasis on, a separate existence, of evil with the demonic forces and that kind of thing. But at least philosophically, this is where Augustine comes down on this, and he's kind of notorious for this definition that evil is the privation of good does not have an existence in and of itself, because everything that exists must be good because God created it. Now, the spiritual nature of sin. Now, here's where he really goes after the heart of pagan ideology. Whereas the Greeks wanted to attempt to escape from the bondage of the body, and viewing the body is evil, and the spirit is that which is good, Augustine argues, well, it's actually the spirit that has corrupted the body, not the body that corrupts the spirit. Looking at the fall of humanity, that sin's origin was not in the body, it was in the soul. When Adam and Eve willed to sin against God, that this is the Christian teaching. If you want to talk about where sin originates, it's in the soul. And this is where the corruption comes from. And again, the idea that body and soul can be in fellowship together as God originally designed that to be. And he, at this point, has strong disagreement with the Stoics that put an emphasis on controlling the passions being evil, and, the wise man is able to check his passions and overcome them all. And Augustine's answer is that all passions are not evil. It depends on that toward which the passions are directed. For example, someone could be compassionate and help others. That's a good thing. And he says the Stoic answer is just too easy anyway, because we cannot just will to be virtuous or to be good. Scripture and experience told Augustine no. Sin is spiritual, and human beings do not have the ability in and of themselves to overcome sin. It's only by the grace of God. And so here's where he, kind of in a frontal assault with classical ethics, you know, begins to deal with this whole issue. Because the good, or the summum bonum, if you would, that the philosophers had pointed to, given different answers to it, but most of the answers had to do with the basically the highest and greatest good that all human beings can achieve is to have a virtuous life and to live a social life. A life lived in a relationship with fellow human beings is part of what will bring us happiness, and a virtuous life can bring you happiness. And this is what eternal life is on a pagan definition. Augustine says to define the good in terms of this life is the vain attempt of the proud. Because Augustine said the good is not, cannot be defined in terms of virtue or health, wealth, or our social contacts, but the good life is only found in truth and in God Himself. And Augustine says, even in social life, you know, our family and our friends disappoint us. We cannot ultimately find happiness there. And so we really have a competing worldviews of paganism and Christianity, and Augustine is arguing for the superiority of the Christian worldview, that we can only find happiness in God Himself.
Can you repeat that quote one time, to define good?
Oh, yeah, sure I will. To define good in terms of this life is a vain attempt of the proud. They basically said, look, you know, Stoics, you have a great idea. This is completely foreign to human existence. There's no human being that can master his or her passions. It's just not possible. Well, these and other philosophical topics he addresses there, and you can see where he's dealing with some very primary distinctives of Christianity. Then he eventually moves to the great definition then that he gives of the city of God. This is the grand vision that this great work of Augustine lays out, which has so captured the Christian imagination ever since this time. This picture that he draws of the city of God. Sometimes the city of God has been characterized as a philosophy of history. I think another way to consider it, maybe it's a theology of history. But it definitely is an attempt to explain human existence and the historical journey of humankind down through the corridors of time. But the basic definition in Book 14, Chapter 28, he begins with this. Accordingly, he says, two cities have been formed by two loves. The earthly city by the love of self, even to the contempt of God. The heavenly by the love of God, even to the contempt of self. The former, in a word, glories in itself, the latter in the Lord. For the one seeks glory from men, but the greatest glory of the other is God, the vain witness of conscience. In the one, the princes and nations it subdues are ruled by the love of ruling. In the other, the princes and the subjects serve one another in love. And therefore, the wise men of the one city, living according to man, have sought for profit to their own bodies or souls or both. But in the other city, there is no human wisdom, but only godliness, which offers due worship to the true God and looks for its reward in the society of the saints, of holy angels, as well as holy men, that God may be all in all. And what you see in this definition that he gives here is that essentially the two cities are distinguished by the objects of their affection. The city of man distinguished by the love of itself, and the city of God characterized by the love of God Himself. Very stark contrast between these two great cities. Now, when he talks about the city of God, the earthly city, or city of man, city of the devil, he uses all three of those terms. He says it originates among human beings in the rebellion of the angels, the earthly city does. So these cities are comprised not only of human beings, but angelic beings. And at the fall, these two societies begin among men. And so men, as they depart from God, become a part of this earthly city, city of man, city of the devil, which is opposed to the spiritual city of God. Now, he does some pretty creative thinking in terms of the way he is going to divide up the historical periods according to the 6 days of creation. So, you know, if you're trying to come up with a standard for looking at the different periods of time, Augustine's going to do it around a parallel with what he sees as the 6 days of creation. And he applies it to these periods, the period from Adam to Noah, Noah to Abraham, Abraham to David, David to the Babylonian captivity, captivity to the birth of Christ, then finally the coming of Christ to the end of the world. So these are the 6 days of human history. And of course the seventh and final day is when the eternal kingdom will come. The full fulfillment of the city of God, that vision that talks about in the New Testament, that how the saints look forward to that eternal city whose builder and maker is God himself. So in these 6 days of creation, and then as he describes it, he talks about there being a morning and an evening in each one of these days. During each one of these periods, we find evidence of those who are faithful and obedient to God. But we also find times where there's a turning away from God. And so there's an evening and morning to each day. Got to give the guy credit for having an ingenious approach to looking at history, comparing it to creation and then morning and evening there. It's interesting to think about, but a real progression in stages. And the purpose of these 6 days and the progression of history is essentially to complete the number of the predestined. Christ is not going to return. The eternal city will not be finally established until all the number of the predestined are in. Predestined men and angels, both classes, where the city of God will return to the beginning. Heaven is the final destination toward which all of this points. Now, as he describes then within this framework of understanding human history, he talks about a number of different aspects that relate to these citizens of the city of God. And some of these are ones that I think have informed Christian thinking and theology in some very significant ways. For example, this whole emphasis that he gives throughout the city of God, that the citizens of the city of God are pilgrims or aliens in this world. There are 58 passages in the city of God where he uses this terminology. The Latin word peregrinus shows up there, pilgrim or alien. Obviously a biblical concept that we are passing through, that we are aliens in this world. We are pilgrims on a journey going to the eternal city. Same kind of picture that John Bunyan uses in Pilgrim's Progress. It's this journey through time. And being an alien is key to understanding who we are as Christians, and just a very basic characteristic. As Christians, we live in a foreign land. Our native city is in heaven. Now, this is not the only place where he mentions this concept, the confessions. You'll find the pilgrim image there also. But think of how that has captured so much of Christian spiritual writing. It's mentioned in the scriptures, but I think through Augustine and his concentration on this theme, that it has really just become a part of our language as Christians to talk about this aspect. And sometimes even hear people, you know, talk about their spiritual experiences, their pilgrimage. You know, it's the journey, and there's a destination where the city is going. Now, enjoyment of God. I think this is helpful for us, and it really explains something that comes out of our own Reformed tradition, in a sense. He contrasts this these ideas of using and enjoying. The Latin's utor and fructus. And he says we need to know the purpose of these things. He says people of the earthly city are attached to worldly matters as if they were the greatest goods. And so what they do is they learn to find their joy in the material things of this world. This is what they enjoy or where they place their joy. He said for the Christians, we have to learn as citizens of the city of God that we are to use the material things that God has given us, but we are only to enjoy God himself. And that's a huge contrast between the two cities. Rather than finding our enjoyment in the things of this life, we only find our enjoyment in God himself. Most of us familiar with the answer to the first question, Catechism, Westminster Confession. Chief end of man is what? Glorify God and what? Enjoy him forever. That is classic Augustinian. That's what the purpose of life is, to find our joy, our enjoyment in him. And this is a theme that shows up in the city of God in multiple passages, not in just a few places. Now, he's not saying that we reject the good of material things. These things are gifts of God. We can use them, but we must not be obsessed by them, which is a characteristic of the city of man. And so there's a balance there. He does say, though, he says, by contrast with the joy that we find in God himself, we ought to have contempt for earthly things by comparison. Just contempt for them by comparison, because our joy is so much found in God himself. And you see here a reflection of the really heart of what he's saying in the Confessions when he talks about being rid of all these things. And he says, Lord, you did come in yourself. My sweetness and my joy, and that deep spiritual experience that St. Augustine had. Now, in that vein, he also talks about the classic definition of peace. The philosophers, in addition to trying to define happiness, they talked about one of the great goals of human experience is to understand what it means to have peace in one's life. And this happiness that we can experience in peace with other human beings. And Augustine says, you know, we can never find peace in this earth. There'll always be tension between human beings. The only true peace will be found in that perfect society which is in heaven. This is the eternal peace. This is the supreme good. And earthly happiness by comparison is misery. I'm going to say that again. Eternal peace that we find in heaven is the supreme good, and earthly happiness by comparison is misery. Again, you see the balance, the temporal peace. This is a gift of God. If we happen to live in a time of earthly peace, we ought to thank God for it, but we don't have our hearts set on that. And as Christians, as aliens, Augustine says, we learn to use peace. We don't see it as the end or the goal. In our mortal life, we need peace, and that's something we can pursue and use earthly peace for good purposes. But Augustine says earthly peace is just solace in the midst of our misery. Solace in the midst of our misery. By comparison. And really, it's these stark contrasts that he makes in these things that, you know, even while he's wanting to have a more holistic view of creation, that, you know, these things God has made is good, but we just live in a fallen world and we are just fools to give our hearts to anything in this world. Because that's ultimately, a part of the city of man tainted by sin. And while we can use these things and give thanks, don't ever give your heart to those things, that you will only find joy, peace, happiness, enjoyment in God himself. Yep, that's a good illustration. Good illustration. Now, part of the controversy related to the city of God is how it has been defined in terms of its relationship to the visible church or the institution of the church. For the medieval Roman Catholic Church, in its usage of the great symbol of the city of God that Augustine lays out here, they tended to make a one-to-one correspondence between the earthly church and the eternal city of God, that the visible presence of the city of God is the church on this earth. Where I think if we read Augustine very carefully, it's most fair to say that really Augustine is talking about the eschatological church, the church at the end of time, that it in effect is a spiritual entity. And remember, it contains both angelic beings and human beings. And while it has a visible presence, partially by the church, you cannot equate the church with the city of God fairly in the writings of Augustine. But that did happen in the Middle Ages. Now, the Reformation made some shifts there in understanding, I think, a little more correctly with a spiritual interpretation, that these are spiritual entities rather than this church-state alliance, this Imperium Christianum, if you would, of the high Middle Ages and union of church and state, that kind of thing. Well, with the this picture of it being the eschatological church, this perfect church of the future, where we as aliens and sojourners, as a part of the city of God, are awaiting its fulfillment, ultimately, in this comprehensive way, Augustine does, at the end of the book, give us his views about end times, because that's all a part of the picture that he's painting now, the progression of history, that it will have an end point as God brings the city of God to its final fruition. And so I want to just introduce in a brief fashion at this point, what had the church pondered about the end of time up to this point? What can we glean were some of their ideas about this return of Christ? The creeds that we've seen so far mention about the fact that he's coming again, that he will come to judge the living and the dead. But how do they understand the details of that second coming? And we find a diversity in the fathers. And Augustine's going to lay out his particular view, which really will become the predominant view of the church for 1,000 years. There's very little questioning. There are some who take a little different angle, but again, his influence in understanding the end times is just huge. But prior to Augustine, just to mention a few things, we do see in men like Justin Martyr, out of his dialogue with Trypho, he had used this picture of the 7 days of creation as 7 millennia of human history. Picking up on that passage in the 2 Peter, that a day is as 1,000 years. And he tended to view this millennial age that would begin with the second coming of Christ. So it's probably fair to say, for those of more a premillennial persuasion in their eschatological views, that Justin Martyr is the first premillennialist. Irenaeus of Lyon talks about a millennium and some of the physical pleasures involved with that to prepare us for eternity, and also sees kind of a second coming before that. Origen, as you might guess, took an allegorical interpretation. What's an Alexandrian to do? Looking at the end times, and particularly the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation, these are apocalyptic symbolic books. What's the deeper spiritual meaning? That fit very easily within his interpretive methodology. And so he tended to look at apocalyptic literature in this spiritual vein. Now, when the great persecution broke out under the time of Diocletian and Galerius, you might be interested to know that some of the Christians began to identify Galerius specifically with the beast in the book of Revelation. You know, modern Christians are not the first ones to name people with some of these events we find in the book of Revelation. And you could imagine where that might be the case. Leading up to the year 1000 in the Middle Ages, there was a renewed stirring of speculation about end times, particularly with those that had tended to use the 7 days of creation, the 6 days of creation and a thousand-year period, and some had suggested that maybe this last thousand years had been inaugurated with the coming of Christ. And when we get up to the year 1000, Jesus is coming back again. So here you had, you know, this literalist interpretation, and there were some suggestions about that. And, you know, Constantine's victory, some interpreters even suggested that maybe this is the beginning of this millennial golden age, you know. And you could imagine where everything is kind of flip-flop in such a short period of time that now we have a Christian emperor, the golden era is beginning. Maybe this is the millennium. So early Christians had a variety of ideas about these things. But Augustine, within the structure that he has in the different 6 days, when it comes to looking at the notion of the millennium described in the book of Revelation, Augustine believed that the millennial age began with the first coming of Christ. This is when the millennium begins. And so the church age, that is the time of existence of the church on earth through the bishops and the saints, that the departed saints reign with Christ, and as do the saints upon this earth, that we are joint heirs with Him and we are reigning with Him now. He is King and Sovereign and Lord, seated at the right hand of the Father on high, and we are now living in the golden age of the millennium that St. John had prophesied in the book of Revelation, that it is beginning. And he picked up on some of the language about Satan being bound. Remember him being bound for 1000 years that we find there in the book of Revelation. And he believed that Satan was hindered and bound during this church age. The first resurrection is spiritual. You know, one of the interpretive difficulties in Revelation 20 is these first and second resurrections. And how do you interpret it? And Augustine clearly argued for this first resurrection being a spiritual entity, and the second resurrection being the return of Christ in this last judgment. So the millennium is now the time where the saints live on this earth. When Christ comes again, the final judgment will take place. And the thrones that are mentioned, the saints that are reigning with Christ on the thrones in Revelation 20, are essentially ecclesiastical authority. And that the saints reign with Him during the present time. Now you can see how influential this kind of thinking would be. This is a rough equivalency of what we might describe as an amillennial view. There are some who've tried to interpret that St. Augustine in a more postmillennial vein, but at least it seems to me that the amillennial notion seemed to fit the best with what he's articulating. But this was of huge influence throughout the history of the church, and this is basically the view that the mainstream Protestant reformers would embrace. Now, post Reformation, there were, you know, eventually be some renewed interest down the road, really sometime later in a premillennial understanding. Although there were some of the Anabaptists that, even in the 16th century, began to talk about this imminent return of Christ and setting up the kingdom on earth and that kind of thing. But this view really had hegemony in the history of the church for a long, long time, and comes out here in the City of God. Let me just pause at that point, see if there are any comments or questions about anything that we've talked about thus far in these writings of Augustine. Anything?
Just comment a little bit on his understanding of the existence of evil. Hmm.
Well, in terms of, the origin of evil. Well, I would say...
What do you think about that?
Oh, Augustine's definition?
The definition of evil, and how would that stand in... How would that definition stand in, say, contemporary Reformed circles?
I think it,
How would the commentators follow it?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert in that particular... you know, area. I mean, it's the age-old problem, you know, of theodicy that the church has dealt with over the, you know, over the years. I think the, you know, traditional Protestant, you know, viewpoint is that the, you know, the fall of the angelic beings is kind of the origin of evil. And although, you know, biblically, we have very scant evidence about these things. We know that demonic powers and Satan show up on the scene, but where all that originated, and it does seem to be that Satan was a created being. Okay, now that would be where part of the difference would be, because Augustine is talking about, in essence, you know, evil having not having any existence in and of itself, although he could argue with the, you know, creation of Satan as an angelic, you know, being that, you know, God didn't make Satan evil. But we've tended to give more credence to this notion, if you would, of evil kind of taking on a life of itself within the kingdom of darkness, and, you know, Satan and his minions being very powerful. And in being much more than just a simplistic, well, it's the absence of good. That it's an independent entity in existence in and of itself that's incredibly powerful. So I think while his definition is intriguing, it doesn't answer a lot of the questions, I think, about the origin of evil. But a lot of it still, you know, is based upon our trying to grapple with the you know, the existence of evil in this person of the serpent and Satan, who shows up, you know, in the Genesis account out of nowhere. It just kind of shows up and doesn't really tell us explicitly. And
his position is one where people take it and say it's really not a hole, it's just not turned dirt. Like the example where there's land and hole dug out, but his position
would
be, no, it's not a hole, there's just not any dirt there.
That's interesting. I never thought of it
really
quite like that.
So is he really saying that evil doesn't exist?
Is
his position really that evil doesn't exist?
It does not exist as a creation of God. Yes. That is what he's saying. Now, here's the thing that's most helpful. You got to remember.
I'm trying to understand exactly what he's saying.
Right. And the best way to understand what he's saying is what he's reacting to. And it's Manichaean, the Manichaeist philosophy, which says that eternal evil and eternal good have existed forever. And Augustine says, absolutely not. Matter, as God created it, all things that God made were good. That's what he's...
So is it better to understand in the context of what he's writing?
Yes, that is the best way to understand what he's reacting to. And he's wanting to make that argument very powerfully, because in and of itself it doesn't answer all the questions. Now, he certainly believes in the reality of Satan and the fallen angels. They help make up the city of the devil. But in the city of God, when he's addressing that, he's trying to deal with that, you know, Manichaean perspective. Glad to have you.
Thank you.
And your name?
Marvin Little.
Hey, Marvin. Hi. Good to see you. Where are you from?
I'm from Concord.
Okay. Not too far away.
Born and raised.
All right. Good. Glad to have you.
The preceding program has been brought to you by Reformed Theological Seminary and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole for sale or for profit without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.